From WXXI News, it's 1370 Connection. I'm Bob Smith, along with Matthew Leonard, here in the WXXI studios, as we continue our trek along the Innovation Trail, and specifically following the power lines along the trail to see what we can find out about New York's energy future. All of the different avenues, from renewable resources to nuclear power to coal-fired and gas-fired and more, and what each type of power will play in the whole matrix of energy delivery here in New York State.
And I'm Matthew Leonard, editor of the Innovation Trail, and you can review the reports that we're talking about at innovationtrail.org. We've got them all up there with photos, video, and you can listen to the audio as well. As you said, Bob, this complex document that the Cuomo administration put out late last year has a lot of different components to it, and that's really why we wanted to sort of pull the rug apart a little bit and look into some of the different issues that this large document addresses. Folks who were listening in the first hour would have heard a little bit of reference to this huge transmission project, a big marquee project of the Energy Highway Blueprint. This is the future of New York's energy vision, as far as the Cuomo administration is concerned anyway. This Champlain-Hudson Power Express, or the CHPE, is a new $2.2 billion transmission project that's supposed to be able to deliver 1,000 megawatts of electricity to New York City, and it's going to be commissioned, if it's successful, it's going to be commissioned in 2017. We sent one of our reporters, Sarah Harris, up north of the U.S. border, and she begins her report where that power would begin.
Electricity is cheap in Quebec. Hydro-Quebec, a state-owned utility, has over 60 generating stations that use the province's rivers to produce power. One of them is Beauharnois, southwest of Montreal, on the St. Lawrence River. It's a long brick building. Men in jumpsuits and hard hats work on giant rumbling machines that generate power.
So we're standing inside the turbine at the Beauharnois generating facility. Above us are magnets, and below us is a giant turbine with water rushing over it.
But hundreds of miles south in New York City, power is really expensive. A lot of demand, plus congestion on the state's grid, means that ratepayers' electricity bills are through the roof. But what if you could funnel cheap power from Quebec into the New York City market? Donald Jessome is president and CEO of Transmission Developers Incorporated. His company plans to do exactly that.
You know, we're connecting one of the strongest systems in North America, in Quebec, to the other strongest system in North America, which is New York.
TDI's project is called the Champlain-Hudson Power Express. They want to run an underground HVDC transmission line from the Canadian border under Lake Champlain, under the Hudson River, the East River, and the Harlem River, and into New York City. The line would deliver 1,000 megawatts of power and cost at least $2.2 billion. The plan is currently before New York State's Public Service Commission. Canadian power producers often look south across the border for business. But Hydro-Quebec only has one transmission line that crosses the border into the U.S., from James Bay in far northwestern Quebec to Boston. So the Champlain-Hudson Power Express is a big opportunity. Maxime Longteau is director of wholesale markets at Hydro-Quebec. He explains that the company works to keep prices low in the province and makes their money from the energy they export.
And for us, it is going to be an extremely important project because that's really a market that we don't have access to right now. New York City, we cannot sell to New York City physically right now.
This project basically is an electrical extension cord from Canada, just flooding the marketplace in New York.
Gavin Donahue is head of the Independent Power Producers of New York, a trade association. He says that the Champlain-Hudson Power Express puts New York State's power producers at a disadvantage.
You do have struggling areas in upstate New York where smaller power plants are trying to make a go of it and make their investment be real viable in the state. And this project will certainly take away huge ability of them to prosper in an economic development way.
And Donahue says the capacity that CHPE will supply already exists in New York State.
We have across the state, I'm going to say in upstate New York, probably 3,000 megawatts of excess capacity just sitting there every day. So when you come down to, does the marketplace need this power? To us, it's obvious that it does not.
Then there's the economics. Donahue believes the $2.2 billion price tag on the transmission line is a lowball estimate. And Jean-Thomas Bernard, a professor of electricity economics at Quebec's Laval University and the University of Ottawa, says that hydropower will face tough competition from natural gas in the marketplace.
Hydro-Quebec, 5-6 years ago, was netting about 8-9 cents per kilowatt hour on the export market. Nowadays, they have difficulty getting 3 to 4 cents per kilowatt hour due to this huge plunge of the natural gas price. So I am rather pessimistic about this development.
TDI estimates that communities along the route will see around 1,200 induced jobs during the line's construction. The company agreed to use union labor along the route earlier this month. Right now, they're working with Blackstone Group, a major private equity firm, to finance the project. The draft environmental impact statement for the project will be published this spring. TDI hopes to have their permits in place by the end of the year. For WXXI News, I'm Sarah Harris.
And we are going to be joined by Sarah Harris online right now. Sarah, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I've heard various estimates from $2 billion for just completing the whole thing from end to end, and then for an incremental cost to New York State ratepayers, just $800 million for that much alone. And I guess what I would ask is, where's all that money coming from? Is it all just being borrowed on Wall Street through Blackstone Group or some other equity funder? Or where is it all going to come from? And who's going to pay it all back once it's borrowed?
That's a good question. The TDI, Transmission Developers Incorporated, projects that the cost of building the pipeline will be $2.2 billion. If you ask opponents of the project, they estimate that likely the cost will be even more. That remains to be seen. The project hasn't even begun construction yet. In terms of financing, TDI has partnered with Blackstone Group, and they're working now to secure funders. They're confident that banks are interested, that investors are interested. They feel that, debt is not going to be an issue for them. But that, as of yet, also remains to be seen. This is a project that is, as of yet, pretty theoretical. They haven't been approved by the Public Service Commission. They haven't broken ground yet. So I guess, in a lot of ways, the answer to your question is, we'll see.
Hi, Sarah. Yeah, in that report, what was interesting was your comment from Jean-Thomas Bernard, who was talking about the kind of the state of the market in north of the border in Canada, and obviously the kind of falling prices for hydroelectric power that Hydro-Quebec are able to get at the moment. So clearly, access to the New York market seems to be pretty critical to their business model going forward. In light of that observation he made.
Right. Hydro-Quebec is developing a lot of resources throughout the province. They're damming far-flung rivers. They're building new generating facilities. And they're doing that, they say, not exclusively for the purpose of export, but to back up their whole system, to make sure that they can supply demand. And what they do is they meet the Quebec load, and they do that by selling electricity at cost. So it's cheap for Quebec ratepayers. And then the rest of the business model is where they make their money by exporting. So, yeah, I would say that, they've exported for a long time. They have a line that goes into Boston presently. But the Champlain-Hudson Power Express and access to the New York City market would be really important to them going forward.
Right.
Another thing I might add is that in terms of TDI, in regards to the previous question, TDI says that New York City ratepayers and New York State ratepayers won't assume the cost of pipeline or of the transmission line. They won't assume those costs. They won't see them in their bill. That has yet to be seen. Also.
Right. So they're giving an assurance that the cost of the production is not going to be passed on to ratepayers. And they're also making some other undertakings that, in fact, I guess people are going to see their bills go down because of the access to this supply. Is that something they're also saying?
That is what they're saying. Power in New York City is expensive, and they're saying that, if economic has its way, rates will be reduced significantly for electricity customers in New York City with the advent of this project.
Right.
Are they proposing actually to distribute this power, to send it, once it gets across the New York State-Quebec border, straight down to New York City, straight into the tri-state area, or will there be any tap whatsoever for other portions of the state of New York?
There won't be any tap whatsoever, and the power will go directly from Quebec to New York City, which means that communities along the way in the Champlain Valley, in the Hudson Valley, in the North Country, you know, further south, they're not going to see, they're probably not going to see that, you know, the reduction in their electricity costs. They're not going to be able to get any of this power.
Yeah, and just to clarify that, the point, Bob, is something that Matt Richmond mentioned too. It's because of the technology that they're using, this HVDC, high voltage DC current, doesn't have the capacity to have it drawn off along the way because for technical reasons. So,
which makes you scratch your head in a sense, because the traditional way to transmit electricity long distances for the last 130 years has been to do it by AC.
Yeah.
That's what made long-distance transmission lines possible in the first place when Nikola Tesla convinced General Electric to put out AC generators back in the 1880s and 90s.
But one of the reasons for that that they've gone with this model is because it has lower impact when it goes underwater. That's one of the primary reasons, because they're going to route this thing, correct me if I'm wrong, Sarah, they're going to route it through the bottom of Lake Champlain down the Hudson River. And so the HVDC technology is really crucial to their ability to deliver this project.
Which seems like an odd choice in and of itself.
Well, I just wanted to pick up on the other voice you had in there, because there's a couple of strands going in your great report there, Sarah. One, the independent power producers are obviously not so keen on this particular project. Just give us a sense of why they're so opposed to this. Clearly this imported power model that's going to, you know, deliver power into the biggest market in the state.
They make the case that the capacity that the line will supply already exists in New York State. There are a lot of power producers in northern and in western New York who are trying to make a go of it. And the independent power producers of New York argue that this line will flood the marketplace and will prevent, you know, the little New York State guys from competing in the marketplace. They would like to see New York City's electricity needs supplied by New Yorkers, not by a foreign country.
Right, and the jobs argument is an important part of this as well, because I think even in the submissions that have been made to the Public Service Commission, the New York Public Service Commission, who's yet to sign off on this Champlain-Hudson project, there are concerns around the sort of the job impact. What are the arguments around job, about, you know, the pros and cons around job creation around all this?
Sure. So TDI says that when they build the line, there will be around 1,200 induced jobs, construction jobs, you know, secondary jobs, feeding people, housing people, you know, who are building the line. But what opponents of the line would argue is that, you know, we need to be making more jobs than just construction jobs for New Yorkers. They need to be the people who are generating power.
And this project will not have any long-term ongoing maintenance and operational jobs beyond the ones that are created temporarily to build the project then?
I think so. I think that's the case. I'm not entirely sure.
Our thanks to Sarah Harris, who has filled us in on the project, which many say will fill the gap caused by the possible closure of the Indian Point nuclear plant and help keep everything humming in New York City, keep the lights on in the downstate region if Indian Point is gone, and maybe even if Indian Point is not shut down. Sarah, thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And now we want to remind you that there are a number of different points of view on the construction of this new power line from Quebec down through to the Hudson Valley of the New York City area. And there are those who say that it may just end up costing people throughout the state, even if they don't get the benefits of the power. We talked with Rochester area State Senator Ted O'Brien, who's raising serious questions about the cost and the equity of cost sharing across the state for the Quebec to New York City connection. Right now, Ted, good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Now, I gather am I right in saying that it all starts with the fate of the Indian Point nuclear plant, several hundred miles away down the lower Hudson Valley north of New York?
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, there's been some advocacy for closing the Indian Point Energy Center for some number of years. And in response, the Public Service Commission has issued a directive to Consolidated Edison and the New York State Power Authority to come up with a contingency plan that would talk about closing the Indian Point nuclear power plant and replacing the power provided by Indian Point. And so that was the beginning of the discussion. And the plan that was presented by Con Ed and New York State Power Authority indicated that the cost would be some $811 million. But unlike any application I've seen to the Public Service Commission talking about what ratepayers will pay, this particular plan would not limit payment to those customers of the Indian Point Nuclear Center, but would spread the cost across all of New York State. And the impact on upstate taxpayers is estimated at some $200 million, even though upstate taxpayers never had any benefit from the energy produced at that center.
Would I be right in assuming that this would be an issue, at least in that sense, if Indian Point were feeding power to the whole statewide grid and involved in a pool that fed Syracuse, Rochester, Buffalo, and Binghamton,
yes,
as well as the greater New York City area?
Then I think it would be more consistent with what the precedent has been, where when somebody proposes a rate increase, that impacts the customers of that respective utility. But that's not the case here, where Con Ed and the New York Power Authority, presumably because of the enormous costs involved, have submitted a contingency plan to the Public Service Commission that requires upstate New York ratepayers to subsidize the project as well.
And how did that exception get worked in? Is there some thought that whatever replacement facility that's put into place, either a power generation facility or some kind of a power line, will be tappable by upstate utilities? Or are we even going to get any benefit for the replacement?
You know, I think that Con Ed and the New York State Power Authority responded to the Public Service Commission with this contingency plan. It's, if we close, this is what we want to do. And I think the driver has been the enormous costs associated with trying to replace that power, both in closing the plant and finding replacement power, $811 million price tag. And I think that they just felt that this was something that couldn't be absorbed by their ratepayers. And so they looked to expand the potential contributors to the expense of such an enormous project to all ratepayers in New York State, including upstate.
I take it they are not necessarily promising that whatever replacement power is provided is going to be shared statewide?
That's right. That's my understanding is that there really would be no benefit to upstate taxpayers or ratepayers. And that's where I think it's just fundamentally unfair. And as a result, Bob, I've written to the acting commissioner at the Public Service Commission expressing my concern and indicating that proposed rate increase isn't fair to upstate ratepayers. And it's really at a time when electricity rates are already like double the national average in New York, and all of our efforts to invigorate our economic development efforts in upstate communities would really be have this additional obstacle to overcome if this tremendous cost was passed on to upstate ratepayers.
Of course, a lot of people are wondering right now as well, now that you mention it, why New York State ratepayers pay more on average per kilowatt hour than most of the rest of the country. And they wonder, is it just because our costs are inherently higher? Is it because perhaps the Public Service Commission hasn't been as aggressive as it could have been in monitoring and perhaps restraining rate increases? Or could it be the nature of how power is generated and sold itself that we don't have a public power authority like the Tennessee Valley Authority or, well, even what Fairport has for Fairport Electric?
you know, Fairport Electric is able to do a great job at keeping costs down, and maybe there's some lessons for us there. And I think, you know, there has been a push to continue to try to diversify the sources of energy. And of course, nuclear power has been an important part of the total energy production package in New York State for a long, long time. What's somewhat concerning is that there hasn't been any particular safety concerns at Indian Point with respect to any other nuclear power facility in the state, and again, that would seem to me to point to the inherent unfairness of asking all New Yorkers to help subsidize the cost of this closure if it's determined that that's the course that utility and their customers want to go.
Incidentally, speaking of that, comparing Indian Point to a number of other nuclear facilities, including a bunch of them that we have on the south shore of Lake Ontario between
right.
20 and 80 miles east of Rochester,
right.
One in Wayne County and a bunch more in Oswego County, nobody's talking about taking them offline. In fact, they've been relicensed for an additional period of time, and some of them won't be even subject to license review again for anywhere from 17 to 30-some-odd years. So could it be that Indian Point could just idle on for its useful life?
It could. And with respect to the discussion whether Indian Point should remain open or closed, you know, my letter to the Public Service Commission didn't weigh in on that. That's a decision for those ratepayers to and their utility company to make decisions on. My point is really just passing the Indian Point costs onto upstate taxpayers seems unfair, and particularly, as you point out, in light of the fact that we have many nuclear power facilities in upstate New York, including some not too far from the Rochester region.
And nobody is talking about closing them down right now.
Right.
I don't think so.
And I think it's really a recognition of the fact that right now we're not at a place where we could replace that energy very easily. That's also true at Indian Point, and that's why the costs are so high.
Of course, they could also say that there's a greater environmental danger from some of the coal-fired plants that we do have in the upstate region. One comes to mind in Dunkirk that's, I believe, operated right now by NRG, by the successor to National Fuel, and feeds into the grid that traditionally was serviced by the old Niagara Mohawk Company. That one's putting out a lot of smoke. And are we going to need to take a look at plants like that and see if they can continue in operation, at least without some serious retrofitting to convert them from coal to gas fire or some similar less environmentally unfriendly means?
That's exactly right. I think we do have to examine that. And of course, a very local example is that, you know, one of the obstacles to economic development efforts at the Eastman Business Park has been their coal-fired plant there. And as a private company that wasn't a public utility selling energy to people outside of what was then the Eastman Kodak Company, you know, they didn't have to comply with all the clean air requirements. And so it's a very significant issue as we look to revitalize efforts at the Eastman Business Park that this company is willing to bear at least a good part of the cost of transforming that plant to a natural gas-fired one, which, of course, would be a much cleaner operation. And that looks to be happening, and we think we have to look at those kinds of issues with respect to coal-fired plants as well.
And certainly RG&E was, because they decommissioned some plants, one that comes to mind along the Genesee River near downtown and another one out near the lakeshore. So, I mean, certainly they are not keeping their coal-fired plants going in the same way even as NRG is. Are we going to have to take a long look at the whole matrix of power generation in this area and see what's sustainable and who's doing that?
Yes, and I think your point, Bob, is that really we may have some very significant costs as we move forward into the next century with cleaner technologies. And to ask us to absorb the costs for a plant that we have not benefited from or will benefit from puts us in a much more tenuous position of being able to deal with the own energy issues that we have to deal with upstate. And that's critically important. And one of the reasons why I'm advocating that we don't share this cost this way, because, you know, we have our own issues to deal with.
And my thanks to State Senator Ted O'Brien for joining us in this discussion of our energy future. I'm Bob Smith with you on 1370 Connection on WXXI. Where we will return in just a moment to take a look at renewable technologies and what part of the energy picture they may very well play in the near future. You're listening to 1370 Connection along the Innovation Trail with Matt Leonard. I'm Bob Smith. We're back in a moment. Connection continues on WXXI. We're along the Innovation Trail and exploring specifically the future of energy in New York State. I'm Bob Smith with Matt Leonard of the Innovation Trail.
That's right. And you can go to innovationtrail.org to review the stories we're presenting, recapping with you during 1370 Connection today. And we're taking a turn out now to Buffalo again, to look at solar power. In mid-2012, the New York Sun Initiative was launched. This is a big subsidy fund, essentially, driven by the Cuomo administration to make solar power in New York State more affordable. Our reporter at WBFO, Ashley Hassard, took a look at the scheme and reports on plans to increase the uptake of solar energy installations in the state.
Adam Rizzo and his crew are installing a set of solar panels on the roof of a church near Buffalo. It takes his company, Solar Liberty, about 3 days to finish the job, but it takes the consumer a bit longer than that to come out ahead of their initial investment in solar.
We like to talk about it in terms of payback instead of upfront cost because each homeowner is a little bit different. But right now we're seeing 4 to 5 year paybacks for our solar systems. And once that payback is met, then you have free electricity for the remainder of the system, which can be 35 plus years.
That long, relatively low maintenance life cycle for solar technology is one of its biggest selling points. But of course, upstate New York's known for its occasional gloomy day, so systems still need backup, either from battery storage or the grid. Adam's brother Nathan Rizzo says there's a good reason your solar panels go offline during blackouts.
If the power fails, the solar system turns off, so it's not sending power back onto the grid if there's ever linesmen working on it.
The solar uptake in New York has doubled photovoltaic or PV installations since 2011, but the technology still has its critics. For one thing, the carbon emissions solar technology generates in the manufacturing and transport stage. Nathan Rizzo says that footprint quickly dissipates, especially compared to fossil fuels.
Transporting it to the job site, manufacturing it, all of those CO2 emissions that are being created throughout that manufacturing process, it only takes 2 years to pay it back, and then it truly is a clean technology that's not harmful to the environment.
From a church roof to roughly 600 student apartments on the University at Buffalo campus. A year ago, UB flicked the switch on their $7 million solar strand on campus. Chief Sustainability Officer Ryan McPherson says students are now working with Professor Vladimir Mitten to make those solar panels more efficient.
So as you can imagine, the ones on the space station are incredibly efficient, but have a very, very high cost, right? And the ones that might operate a little plant on a dashboard in a car going back and forth are very cheap and inefficient.
In order to bolster progress in the solar sector, the Cuomo administration wants to continue the level of funding that its major solar initiative, NY Sun, receives for another decade. The plan is expected to attract more private sector investment for solar. NYSERDA President and CEO Frank Murray says a key factor in making solar more investor-friendly is improving the capacity for energy storage.
Smart grids will minimize the impacts of future natural disasters on consumers by helping to enable individual premises and microgrids, in effect, islanding themselves to provide power to pockets of consumers when central power plants or portions of the transmission and distribution system are inoperable.
New York's solar industry currently receives a range of subsidies through the state's power authority, NYSERDA, and the federal government. Richard Caperton is the managing director for the Energy Center for American Progress. He says solar energy still needs those incentives to level the playing field against heavily subsidized fossil fuels.
Since 1918, the oil and gas industries have gotten almost $500 billion in subsidies from the federal government. So the federal government has always provided some level of incentive for energy technologies, and solar energy is no different.
Caperton says solar power's increasing affordability is driving the growth in solar-related manufacturing, installation, and operations jobs across the country. Recently, the National Energy Renewable Lab put out a plan to help get the United States to 80% renewable energy by 2050. But to that, Caperton says it's going to take more than just solar.
You don't do that with just wind or with just solar or with just hydropower. You need all of them. Different parts of the country are going to use more or less of different technologies, but the country as a whole needs all of those technologies to provide our power.
And Ashley Hassett was reporting there for the Innovation Trail from WBFO, and Ashley's on the line now. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Matthew. How are you?
Fine, thanks. That was an interesting report, because I think when you set out on it, you realized that there was still a lot of, I guess, misunderstandings or a lack of understanding about how solar technology even works at the moment.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. When I set out on this journey, I thought I was going to just, you know, focus on NY Sun. But I realized people still are kind of wondering how solar power works. They're wondering, you know, well, what's the point of it, if it's hooked into electricity still. But, you know, as I found, I mean, I definitely wanted to weed that out and really explain, you know, how it works, why it's connected to electricity, and why it receives subsidies. So
yeah,
definitely interesting.
We had a caller in the first hour that you probably wouldn't have heard. Richard mentioned that he'd been involved in solar installation and raised the issue that you addressed in your report, which is, you know, okay, we know there are occasionally cloudy days in upstate New York. Okay, we concede that. So, but the picture that you presented in that was that solar, it's really important that solar is integrated into the grid through increased storage capacity and other kinds of backups. That seems to be the really crucial part of the solar plan going forward that needs to be sort of addressed.
Yeah, definitely. Batteries are expensive is what I'm hearing, and that's the only way to not be hooked into you know, electricity, and it's definitely the most important thing going forward is making those batteries, you know, less expensive. And it's definitely going to be a process, is what it sounds like, in order to do that. Lots of research and everything going forward.
And what sort of research are the students doing? Could you tell us a little bit more about how and why the students are trying to make the panels that you talked about at the UBuffalo campus more efficient? What sort of things are they trying to do, if you can explain?
Well, it is very in-depth of what they're doing. They actually are working with the batteries in, you know, specifically in the parts that are inside of batteries in order to make them cheaper and easier to afford, especially when they're going over to other countries and trying to give, you know, people in Haiti and in different islands power. So they definitely need to find a way to make those particles that batteries are made out of, you know, more, you know, less expensive. So I think that's what they're really working on. And I don't know the specific names of the, you know, say particles in pieces that they're working on inside of batteries, but I know that that's a huge thing that they're working on.
Right.
And also what, how the panels are framed, that's a huge thing too, because the way that the panels are framed now, it's the framework is actually taking up some space to where panels could actually be stretched out bigger in order to take in some more sunlight. So that's also a thing they're working on as well.
Huh. One thing that probably a lot of people wonder, and it was alluded to by callers and, of course, in the course of your conversation as well and your research on it, was how much of a factor that solar power can play in this part of the country, which is often kind of covered in clouds like it is today. And I think it's true that even on a day like today, you can get some solar energy, although it's probably not as much as you'd get if we were in Phoenix or Las Vegas today, is it?
I know. Yeah, the thing I was learning, which was actually very interesting, is actually in Germany. Germany is a very gloomy, cloudy place most of the time, and they are like number one for solar power. So, I mean, it's so funny. I was learning that you think about, you know, the fact that the sun's not out, but it really is emitting some sunlight in order to get that, you know,
registering
solar power.
The power. Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is, you know, they account for days that that don't have the sunlight out because, you know, that's just going to happen. But it was just really interesting to learn that in Germany that they're number one and it's pretty gloomy. So it obviously here we're pretty sunny compared to that. So.
Yeah. So we mentioned in your report when you were talking to the contractors from Solar Liberty who are doing installations that, you know, we know there's a kind of bigger upfront cost with solar, but that cost then the proponents of solar energy argue is kind of offset by the low maintenance, long sort of life that solar panels can have when they're put in place. So, but that's the reason why these initiatives are still so important, that funds like New York Sun still need to be there to kind of buffer, you know, provide that buffer for that initial heavy startup cost on solar.
Yeah, you know, and what I was learning was that, you know, just because something is going to take a little while to pay back doesn't mean it's not good for you in the long run. I mean, like I was learning, you know, solar eventually will be a clean technology, and it's just going to take some time to pay that large cost off. And what I was learning from Richard is that the price of solar is actually going down as researchers find different ways to make the framework for panels more efficient and batteries more efficient, the grid technology more efficient. So I was really learning that solar is actually going down in price as the years go, and you know, we can only hope that, you know, all the work that people are doing on it is for something.
Is the best and most likely use of it, at least for now in this part of the country, going to be as a supplement, either a backup in case the grid fails, or I know you got to take it, find a way to decouple it from the grid in order to make it work that way, like a generator, but mm-hmm. Is it going to be sold in that context, or is it simply going to be sold as an environmentally friendly alternative to being on the grid?
I guess kind of both. I mean, I really think that it's important that it definitely will offset some of the, you know, cost of your electricity, but also will be like a healthy, I guess, alternative to fossil fuels. But what I like most about it is solar going forward in the future will actually work the best if it's combined with wind power and it's combined with hydropower. And I think that was the most interesting thing because, again, I was doing all of this learning about solar because I'm just as, you know, ignorant, I guess, if you want to use that word, and not knowing anything about it. I was really that person, and I guess I was learning that the best way to utilize solar power in the future would be to, combine all of those renewables in order to get the best results from renewable energy.
And has anybody talked about building large-scale solar generation facilities in other parts of the country that get a lot of sun and perhaps hooking it up to the grid and sending it back through the line so it can have regional or nationwide distribution, the same way a big power plant would?
Yeah, that's really a good thought. And no, I didn't hear anyone say that. I know you think of, you know, especially with like places like California and Florida, you know, just on the East Coast, if you're thinking, and you know, the Carolinas. But you know, I didn't hear anybody specifically say that's what's going to happen going forward for that. So, I mean, it would be really probably a good idea because they talk about sending power up and down the state here. So I assume, you know, sending it up and down the country could be a thought going forward.
It'd be interesting to see how that develops. Ashley Hassett, thank you very much for bringing us up to date on some of the alternative technologies that are at work right now as we examine New York's energy future. Thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
And we are going to reach out right now to Richard Caperton, who is the executive director of the Energy Center for American Progress, who contributed to the report that you just heard from our Innovation Trail reporter, Ashley Hassett, and joins us right now for the Energy Center for American Progress. Richard, thank you very much for taking this time to be with us.
Thank you for having me on. Good to talk to you.
Now, how much should we expect solar power to contribute given the level of today's technology?
Sure. So in the near term, solar power is very, very exciting, as you just heard me talking about, as the costs decline. There are a lot of opportunities for people to use more solar power. In fact, the CEO of Recurrent Energy, who are a large solar power company based out of the West Coast, I think, Arno Harris, just said that he expects next year, 2014, solar power to be the second biggest new source of power in the country, right behind natural gas. So it's clearly a booming industry, and there's a lot of upside for it.
Richard, hi, Matthew here. I'm just wondering the role we heard about the how important it is also to resolve some of these energy storage and kind of redundancy sort of issues with the implementation of solar. How far do you think we have to go, you know, to sort of really address those, you know, particularly the storage issue, I guess, where we're seeing a lot of investor interest moving to storage solutions?
Yeah, it's going to be a problem at some point. It's not a problem that the grid operators are seeing right now. Even in California, which has the most of these variable resources, they've been able to manage the amount of solar and wind they have. But at some point, we will need a lot of storage. Thankfully, there are advances being made today, but the storage technology is not where we need it to be.
One thing I wonder, speaking of storage technology, are there advances being made in the automotive industry in terms of storing electric power that are running cars like the Nissan Leaf or the Chevy Volt or an upcoming Cadillac model, ultra hybrid that's mostly electrically driven, that could be adapted to a wider scale power generation and power storage application?
Absolutely, and that's one of the most exciting opportunities for businesses in this. The interaction between transportation and electricity is figuring out how electric vehicles can be that bridge. There are a lot of challenges that mostly have to do with understanding how electricity markets work and how storage is priced and how you sell power at different times of the day and things that are that your average consumer and your average car owner will never be interested in and will never want to deal with. So there is an opportunity for new businesses and innovative businesses to figure out how to make cars work for that storage solution. And a lot of people are working on it. But technically, it's very, very possible.
There is another emerging technology right now that's both, you would figure, very cheap to tap and yet very controversial. I'm talking about wind power. And it is surprisingly controversial because it seems to have generated, to a great degree, the whole not in my backyard phenomenon. Everybody's interested in it. Everybody's in favor of it in principle. But nobody wants a wind farm anywhere near them. Is that going to be an insurmountable obstacle in a lot of cases?
I mean, let's be clear. More people want a wind farm in their backyard than want a coal-fired power plant in their backyard. It's not like wind power is the worst thing in the world for people. So, but it is a challenge. Some people don't want any construction near their house, and wind turbines are big, especially the new ones are getting larger so that they're more efficient and make power even cheaper. There is a lot of the country where people do want wind turbines near them. Farms in Iowa are really excited about the opportunity for wind power. So this won't be a huge part of the clean energy mix in every part of the country, but it will be a very large part of the mix in some parts of the country.
The farmers are used to it because a lot of them have been using wind power in a mechanical way to generate energy for some of their machinery for 100 years and more. So in a way, I suppose, they're more used to the idea and more receptive to the technology than most of us are. That having been the case, what is going to be done to make it more attractive as an alternative to another, not coal-fired necessarily, but let's say natural gas-fired power plant?
Yeah, a lot of the benefit from, or a lot of the reason that people like having wind power near them is the economic development opportunities. Farmers are in the business of turning their land into money, and this is another way that they can do it by leasing out very small portions of their farm to people who want to put wind turbines on them. And the more that we can get people involved economically in wind power, I think we'll see it become more and more popular. And the same with solar. Not everybody owns their house, and not everybody lives in a house where they can put solar on the rooftop. But the extent to which we develop community-owned business models where you can invest in a solar plant that's somewhere not exactly at your house, or that you can invest in a wind farm, is going to be really exciting to people and bring more people into the clean energy economy.
We heard earlier, Richard, this discussion around a possible conversion of a currently coal-fired power plant to combined cycle. And the attraction of that technology apparently is that you can ramp it up and down pretty quickly to take advantage of sort of peak times around renewables. So we know that there's some intermittent issues with, say, wind, and that, you know, this is a good context for wind because you're able to sort of take care of the, you know, the downtime in the wind, in wind production with this sort of responsive technology. Is that an important part of the thinking in terms of, you know, the fit? We've been talking over the last couple of hours about a real puzzle with a whole lot of different contributing technologies that are supposed to come together, you know, apparently seamlessly to solve New York's power issues going forward. Is that kind of important thinking that you need to make technology more responsive in order to integrate all these different sources of energy?
Absolutely. And the key point you just said is that all these things have to operate seamlessly. There has to be 100% reliability for power. Consumers won't accept anything less than that. So we have to make sure that the lights stay on. Now, there are a lot of ways that we can do that and a lot of tools that we have to deal with the problem that the wind doesn't always blow. One of those things is natural gas power. General Electric just unveiled some new turbines last year that are very, very fast ramping, so that if the wind suddenly stops or almost suddenly stops, then they can ramp up very quickly and then ramp back down very quickly and do it efficiently. The reason that you don't do that in traditional, old-fashioned coal-fired power plants is because you have massive efficiency losses when you ramp them. But GE's new product will do that more efficiently. The other thing is that we need to pair that with improved weather forecasting and wind forecasting. You know, we know that the sun rises every day at a certain time and sets at a certain time. The wind is different. It blows when it wants, and it's not fully predictable. So we need the federal government to keep investing in weather forecasting tools that will help us better predict when the wind is going to stop blowing so that we can then ramp up our natural gas power plant. And it's also important to think of all the other resources we have in addition to natural gas that can back up wind, including hydropower or biomass facilities.
I know you've got to go, Richard. Just one more question, which was just about the role of smart grids, and we haven't talked about them a lot in this segment, but they're also an important part of the thinking around energy going forward, the smart grid technology.
Yeah, a big part of it. You know, there's a lot of the smart grid can do so many things. It's going to transmit data about when you use power and when power is more expensive, so that you can use the most cost-effective power. For reliability purposes and for solar and wind, if there is not enough wind or if there's not enough sun to provide all the power we need, it can even send signals that will help you ramp down your air conditioner, for instance, or power that you don't need exactly at that time, so that the demand for power is more responsive to the supply for power. The smart grid is somewhat magical in a lot of people's minds. It's not going to solve all of our problems, but it's a tool that's going to be critical to the solutions.
And our thanks to Richard Caperton, Executive Director of the Energy Center for American Progress, for sharing his perspective on emerging technologies with us. Richard, thank you very much. We appreciate your taking the time to be with us. I have a couple of calls on the line that we'll take before we go, one of which is from Hal. Hello, Hal. You're on the air with us.
Thank you. This is very exciting. The topics that were discussed are great. The professor of engineering, Mark Z. Jacobson, who's the director of the energy program at Stanford University, co-authored with many New York authors a study for integrating 100% seamlessly of wind, water, and solar energy in New York. And I informed the Innovation Trail website last week about it. There, his plan is, which hasn't been emphasized in this series much, is wind, as you recently were discussing. 40% of it is offshore because continental shelf has so much energy, and 10% onshore. But it's all renewable. It's not clean, so-called frack gas nuclear. It's all renewable. And
We're breaking up your signal there. We're not hearing you quite clearly. So
I'll, Mark, his
We're losing you, Hal, but I do thank you very much for checking in with us. We appreciate your sharing your perspective.
And just to let Hal, we did get your message, and we did actually reach out to the studies of that particular author, but because they were traveling and publicizing the report, we weren't able to get them. But we will be following up our reporting with them on that particular study, which, you know, is clearly presenting an interesting kind of scenario for the integration of renewable energies as opposed to fossil fuel into the energy grid. So we will certainly be covering that in the next couple of weeks.
And time for a quick comment from Emily in the city. Emily, you're there. Hi.
I'm a human being, also known as a consumer, who would rather see safe energy than any other measure, whether that's reliability or cost or anything. And I'm sure the people of Fukushima would agree with me. I opposed the recommissioning of Ginna. And I believe that Indian Point is not a decision to be made only by the local ratepayers. I mean, that kind of accident or contamination would affect far more than the local ratepayers, as the Hanford nuclear plant is currently leaking in Washington, affecting people throughout the region.
All important considerations. If it's any consolation to you, the Ginna plant and the other plants along the Lake Ontario shore are of a fundamentally different design than the one at Fukushima, so we may not be looking at the same degrees of risk, but nobody is going to say any technology on power generation is going to be totally 100% risk-free. So it's certainly an important point to keep in mind. I do thank you for sharing it. Wish we had more time, but unfortunately, we have time only to thank all of our guests over the course of the last 2 hours, thank our reporters along the Innovation Trail contributing to the program, including Matt Richmond, Ryan Delaney, Kate O'Connell, Sarah Harris, and Ashley Hassett. And, of course, special thanks to everybody in the team here at WXXI and the Innovation Trail series. Special acknowledgement to Managing Editor Matt Leonard, my co-host for today, and to our Technical Director, John Andrus. And on behalf of everybody involved here at WXXI, AM and FM HD2 Rochester, I'm Bob Smith. It's been a pleasure.